Today I'm going to talk about string cosmology in the Hagedorn phase, and it all stems from this paper here, which I had very little to do with. It was by Robert Ali and Qumran, where they proposed a mechanism wherein through thermal effects in an initial quasi-static phase close to the Hagedorn temperature, how the dynamics of strings might explain large-scale structure as we see today. And my work has been on following up on this and actually trying to plumb out some very specific predictions that come out of this model. And as the talk progresses, I hope to demonstrate that you can actually potentially say a lot about this model in terms of what can be observed. And in particular, one could conceivably rule it out fairly quickly once Planck starts giving us data on the tensor spectrum. But this work is rooted in, so Brandenburger and Waffe, if you like, in about 1989, started this whole field of string gas cosmology with their initial paper, which they had hoped to provide a mechanism to explain how our universe has three macroscopically observed dimensions and six compact dimensions. And I thought I should just, before I get anywhere, just provide a brief sort of overview of what string gas cosmology is, what its philosophy is, just to sort of motivate it. And so I hope the green writing is somewhat legible. Because in essence, string gas cosmology is not actually that exciting or bold a step to take. If you want to ask the question, what is string gas cosmology, perhaps we should orient ourselves to the question first, what we're doing when we're doing Big Bang cosmology. So when we're doing Big Bang cosmology or standard Big Bang cosmology, you can distill everything that you're doing down to three basic inputs, three basic ingredients. And obviously the first ingredient is you need a theory of space-time and its dynamics. So that's provided to us by Einstein. We couple this theory of gravity to some theory of matter. So matter that couples to this gravity by the Einstein equation. And typically in Big Bang cosmology, we focus on matter contents that are describing point particles hydrodynamic-like fluids. And more recently, we've also applied this to incorporating various fields as part of your matter content. So gauge fields, fermions, scalar fields mostly are the most relevant thing in cosmology. But on top of this, we have to invoke certain symmetries. And this is crucial. This is without this, the other two wouldn't really go very far. And the symmetries that we invoke, the most obvious one is that we assume that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Now, that's quite a bold assumption to make when Friedman, Roberts, and Walker in the Matrix wrote down their equations. It's actually rather philosophically motivated. But today, we know from very, very large-scale observations that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic to a very, very high degree of accuracy. And on top of that, we have to assume certain other symmetries, such as sort of hot democratic initial conditions. And I threw in thermodynamics in there because essentially that's a statement of symmetry in phase space, but all of the successes of standard Big Bang picture have come from applying our theory of what matter was doing in the early universe, how it interacts with gravity, to its thermal history. So Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and et cetera, et cetera, provide us with some very strong evidence. And of course, the existence of the cosmic microwave background at a very at 2.7 Kelvin, which has a black body spectrum. All of these are consequences of incorporating all these three ingredients together. Of course, there are problems with the standard picture, and we have to supplement it with the usual story of having some period of inflation to explain the initial conditions, namely why the universe doesn't have monopoles dominating everywhere, and et cetera. And now, now that we have even more data to work with via the recent WMAP and supernovae data, essentially cosmology has had a lot of unwelcome guests enter its room, but nevertheless, the Lambda CDM model is it fits the data very well, provided we have to adjust parameters accordingly. So that's just a brief reminder of what Big Bang cosmology is, and string gas cosmology is in essence exactly the same thing, philosophically speaking anyway, but we assume that string theory is the true description of nature at high energies. So instead of having Einstein's gravity, our theory, or rather theories depending on which quantum moduli space you're in, is some low energy effective action that comes from string theory. So in general, it's going to be some supergravity, some dilaton gravity. And to that, we now would like to couple more than just the usual story of point particles and fields. I mean, they are around always. But now we have these exciting new objects to work with. Strings, brains, et cetera. And the great thing about these objects is that, you know, they're non-local. They feel the metric out in a way that point particles would, or local quantum field theory would never do. So that's seemingly quite a promising avenue to explore. And in addition to the same symmetries that we had previously, we realized that there's some rather spectacular new consequences that come around from string theory, such as the existence of various new dualities, and in particular, and this is going to be the subject, or the workhorse rather, of what I'm going to be talking about. We find that thermodynamics, if you have strings floating around, is a lot different than in the usual case. Namely because there is, string thermodynamics is somewhat special. There's something that appears to be a limiting temperature, known as the Hagedorn temperature, to contend with. So what, how far does that get us? This is, like I said, just a brief overview, and I'm not going to discuss most of this, but I'd just like to throw up a few of the results that people think that they've obtained from this mechanism. So initially it was proposed to possibly generate a 3+1 dimensional universe, so the dynamics of strings interacting via the universe is the so-called Brandenburger-Bottle mechanism. Now, we're not so sure that that mechanism is still going to work in its initial, in the initial form that it's proposed, namely because string interactions, when you really like to, when you really pay attention to them, won't make this naive dimension counting argument that Brandenburger and Botha proposed go through so simply. So, if you like, I'm not actually going to. I'm assuming everybody here has heard of the Brandenburger and Botha mechanism, but if you haven't, I'm not going to talk about it now. But you can ask me afterwards, and we can discuss. And in a certain sense, if you assume a certain set of approximations. And in a very simple set of situations, so namely if you take heterotic string theory and compactify it on a torus at roughly on the string scale, you find that the dynamics of massless string modes that like to appear at these enhanced symmetry points likes to stabilize all of the moduli associated with the torus that you're compactifying on. So the shape and the radial moduli tend to get fixed back towards a string scale. And by phenomenologically consistent, I mean it's also consistent with all of the bounds we'd like to throw at it from late-time cosmology. So in particular, it will work today. It is consistent to have everywhere in this room, if we had a heterotic compactification on a torus, it is consistent to have a fluid of massive strings everywhere pinching those extra dimensions together.
So the issues which you know, being raised for point one, mm-hmm. why don't they, you know, play point two to stabilize it?
They've got nothing to do with each other.
Why?
Well, I mean, you assume a 3+1 dimensional. What?
Why the physics changes so drastically in these two problems?
I mean, they're two completely different situations, right? One situation, you're trying to answer two different problems. In one case, you're trying to explain how strings intersecting and interacting in a torus might dynamically pop out three dimensions. This, if you like, the second point is, forget that. Let's just say you start out with a universe where six dimensions are already small. In that situation, a gas and massless strings enhance symmetry states that appear at this
you mean that the strings will not never interact? Is that
okay? Oh yeah, that's an assumption made, right? That's yes.
Why should I buy that assumption?
Well, you assume that they've frozen out.
Have you checked those assumptions?
Yes.
Yeah. That they freeze out?
Yeah, yeah.
Why do they freeze out?
I mean, we're talking about something that's relevant right now.
No, at that time, when you're stabilizing the moduli.
Right. The moduli stabilization mechanism started out at some point. I mean, it could have been created. These strings could have been created much, much later than some initial epoch. It could have been created in some stringy reheating or whatever. But if they're just around now.
Okay, go ahead. Those are crap. Go ahead.
Oh, is that right?
Those are crap, please. Go ahead. Please.
Okay. But at any rate, we've had this discussion before. And we'll have it again afterwards. I think you're a bit confused about.
I'm not confused.
I know you've written a paper on the first subject, but there's literally very little to do. It's not the subject of my talk, so I'm not going to go into it here. But afterwards, I can just show you writing down. If you take an energy momentum tensor, right, coming from a string gas fluid, just the level of the Einstein equations, you see how these extra dimensions are stabilized. Of course, there are approximations that go into it, right? I've assumed them, right? And whether you want to justify them or not later becomes another issue. I mean, I'm stating very clearly here that there are a certain set of conditions that I'm assuming. And another condition that I'm assuming is that we've sort of tucked the dilaton away. It's out of sight. It's somehow been stabilized at some scale that we don't care about. And of course, that's a rather drastic assumption. And there's indications to show that string gas topology could actually never, in and of itself, have anything to say about dilaton stabilization. But at any rate, it also seems to contain within it.
I can understand how strings could stabilize Galois moduli, but mm-hmm. How can they stabilize complex structure moduli? That's not obvious. That's how it seems.
Can I show you afterwards? This is not the subject of my talk, but.
No, but you were saying it's possible.
It is possible, yeah, in a certain situation. Yeah. I mean, literally the philosophy is you introduce a gas of strings, right? Physical gas of strings, you're coupling it to gravity, you compute its energy momentum tensor, right? You're not throwing in any potentials generated by anything, you're just literally doing the consistent thing that you're allowed to do, namely the low energy effective background, the supergravity theory that you have, is a consistent background on which to study the propagation of massless strings. So why don't you do that? Why don't you throw in a fluid of massless strings, compute the energy momentum tensor, see how it interacts with your fields, your gravitational field, and you find that.
That's why I said it's obvious that same could stabilize Galois moduli. That's what you're saying, but it is not obvious that could carry.
Oh no, it's not obvious. That's why they're research papers I don't want to.
It's clear.
Okay. No, I mean I was just sort of listing a bunch of results. I mean the real thing that I want to talk about here today is this following last point here, but.
Just a concept. So when you say gas of string, what exactly do you mean? I mean, they are in thermodynamic equilibrium.
No. Have a gas of string. They don't have to be in thermodynamic equilibrium. They might be. Right, I'm just assuming that there is a. I mean, like, you've got a CMB, you've got a gas of CMB photon surrounding you right now. Right? Just like that. These are massive strings. Right? You just have a gas of them somewhere. Everywhere, actually. Okay? It's going to look like some radiation fluid. But anyway, in attempts to make it sort of work in late time cosmology, there are various problems, namely that it doesn't seem to contain a mechanism for inflation. In fact, inflation seems to be fairly inconsistent with having string gases stabilize any moduli, or even, unless of course they're created in some sort of string heating phenomenon, but it's also been used, string gas has also been used to provide a candidate for dark energy. This is a paper by Sixi Rasan and Francesco Ferrer. But in particular, because it seems to be so incompatible with inflation, it's led Robert Brandenburger to wonder, could it somehow do something beyond inflation? That somehow achieve the same ends without actually needing a phase of inflation? So what I'm going to talk about today is the following, and I'm going to...
I'm sorry to come back.
Sure.
So I can understand that when you have strings and if you really want to distinguish strings versus point particles, which would be their flow energy limit, mm-hmm. then it means that whatever modulus is stabilized will roughly be at the string scale. Whatever sizes will imagine will show up in the stabilization will be string-like sizes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if that is the case, then it is inconsistent to use just string gas and a supergravity.
Right, because then there will be infinite set of higher derivatives of alpha prime correction. See, okay, so there's two things I'm going to say to that. The first off is on a toroidal compactification, okay, there is no curvature to the metric. Okay, so you don't necessarily get the derivative correction that you'd expect. This has been checked. But you'd be very foolish to think that if you're at an alpha, if you're at the string scale, that nothing would happen that you don't have control of.
No, but then one, at the end of the day, you will have some cosmology. There will be some, Friedman, Robinson, Walker.
Right.
So there will be some curvature.
Right, but it's in the time direction, well, right? And it's much, much less in the string scale.
But that is the wrong thing to say, that there will be a decoupling in the 10-dimensional, supergravity between a 4-dimensional and toroidal direction. I mean, there is a, arc to the force terms of wild tensor.
Right, and if you compute the curvatures throughout this process, you find that it's very, very, very tiny compared to the string scale.
Well, if everything is a four-day, if you measure...
So what's the curvature of the torus? Let me ask you this. What's the curvature of the torus?
So it is not the curvature of the torus will enter. It will be the curvature of the upper W universe.
Right. And that curvature comes from time derivatives. Right, no spatial derivatives.
No,
and those time derivatives are very, very minor.
But I'm saying that through the higher derivative terms, they will start feeding in and showing up.
Mm-hmm. This point I don't agree with at all, because this has been checked, and I have checked it, and it is, those are vanishing contributions.
You check R to the force terms?
Yes, I mean, you computed 1 over R. I mean, you compute R, and it's minuscule compared to the string.
I'm not talking about 1 over R.
I'm talking about R.
Yeah, but
so if R is small, then R to the fourth can't be very big.
R to the fourth, R is Riemann tensor. It has four indices. There are various ways how you can contract.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, there are ways of contracting where there will be a feed-in from the four-dimensional curvature into a height into your torus.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that at the level alpha prime to the zeros order, it is just zero. It will feed in and show up at the alpha.
And how significant would this be, in your opinion?
You check
but I'm asking you, how significant would this be?
It depends on each particular geometry. And
right,
it
does.
On the whole score of alpha prime corrections in the string. So my observation is only that it appears to be a very strong assumption that you take into account the stabilization mechanism of strings and you stabilize all your moduli at the string scale or string size, and on the other hand, you neglect the complete slew of other corrections that we know are there. And, you have to verify. I don't know. I wasn't working on it.
So to me, it seems very surprising. Okay, so you're saying this is not the case. Let me just reformulate what you're saying. Okay, to me, it's very surprising. What you're saying is that if R corrections are very small, then R to the fourth correction should be significant. That I'm surprised by. Okay, because we have checked that the curvature corrections are very, very tiny.
I'm doing that, but even if they are, I think my understanding is that Robert agrees at this point that you say there was potential to stabilize a delton and it gave it a mass, and that mass is of the order of the string scale. And presumably that's gravitating. And so my understanding was that the claim wasn't that there was a controlled calculation at the string scale of the dynamics in this. That's not to say you shouldn't do it, in the sense that if you...
No. The mass of the radion fields is actually on the order of electron volts.
No, I'm not talking about radion. You said at the beginning that you fixed the deal effect. So the thing is that there's...
That I ignored completely. That took some, yes.
Right, so the thing is, there's things in there that are not approximations in the sense that they're controlled by small parameters, if you're at the string scale. I think that you have to agree with that, right?
Yes. But what I'm saying is that the resulting geometry that you end up with has curvature that is very, very tiny. Right? The only problem is you compactify on the torus, and that is at alpha prime.
That may be true, but it's not sufficient to say that there's no correction.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm expecting corrections. I'm just disagreeing with your point.
That those things can drastically modify your alpha W,
Okay.
Knowledge.
Okay.
So that was my point, that there are, you are assuming it is a point model, and we all do point model, but it's important to understand what things you are assuming, and you know what's.
No, I agree. I agree, and to my best effort, I've tried to check that. I'm not a string theorist, so half of what you're telling me is over my head. But
well, you would expect infinite collections. You don't have to be string theory for that. You just have to be field theory.
I also can say.
Can we talk afterwards, please? This is not the subject of my talk, and I take all of your points, and I'd like to listen to them further. But you don't have to believe in any of that for what I'm about to talk on today. Okay.
Fair enough. I think it's fair enough for you to have your motivation doesn't have to lie. Like,
I was just throwing up just sort of some hodgepodge of things that people have worked on. Just
right. That's fair enough.
Okay. Now. String gas cosmology in the Hagedorn phase is this particular model that attempts to solve the horizon entropy and structure problems, so this large-scale structure that we see today, but not the flatness problem. So in a sense, it's very, very incomplete to people that love inflation. So you really do have to worry about, you know, why it is anybody would be looking for an alternative to inflation, because it has been spectacularly confirmed by observations. To just summarize a list of suspicions that, you know, in general one should keep an open mind to alternatives, to this day there is yet to be a convincing realization of what the inflation is. There's plenty of candidates, but I don't think anybody agrees exactly what the inflation is at the minute. And now that string theory has come about, the situation has improved a lot, whereas previously, when you didn't have candidates for the inflaton coming from geometric moduli or separation between brains, these really were some sort of fields that are part of some particle physics model, then you do have to worry about, you know, why the situation appears to be so finely, has to be so finely tuned, and whether nature actually respects that fine tuning in terms of its particle phenomenology is another issue. Another problem, well, some people think is a problem, is the so-called Transplanckian problem, okay, wherein if you were to work backwards from today, scales that were that are observable today were in fact, you know, if you take a conservative estimate for the number of efolks that you have, let's say 30 or 40, you find that many of the modes that you observe in the sky started out in a period that was sub-Planckian. Now, people have addressed how it might be that Transplanckian physics might affect the CMBR, and there's a lot of controversy about that, and it's not at all clear whether there'll be any observable effect at all, so that might be a moot problem. But another issue is that the singularity problem remains, it doesn't go away. It's not so much a problem, but it's something to always keep at the back of your mind, is that the cosmological constant problem, okay, so now today we have a slightly different take on it, but let's say we're back at the level of the cosmological constant problem circa Weinberg review article. The question could be posed in the following sense. Why is it that the time-independent piece of a potential for a scalar field generates inflation, whereas something that looks a lot like that, which is, you know, the contribution of the bare cosmological constant plus all the zero-point energies of all the fields, why is that gravitationally inert? So it's not so much a problem, but it's definitely a constraint on potentially looking for a solution to the cosmological constant problem. And in particular, if you expect some symmetry to be the solution to the cosmological constant problem, namely that it is exactly zero, and that its small observed value today comes from something else, let's not get into that, but if you expect some symmetry to protect you at some zero cosmological constant problem, you have to worry about how it allows inflation to happen in the first place. And another issue you might want to think about is that inflation has proved to be very difficult to falsify. You really cannot come up with many observations that we could have observed that inflation might not have predicted. So in particular, if WMAP measured a spectral index of 0.5 instead of 0.97 plus or minus whatever, or 1.6, there would have been some mechanism for inflation that would have generated. Essentially, one is a signature of de Sitter, of a phase that approximated de Sitter enough. But we all know that there's parallel inflation, which is sub de Sitter, and there's super exponential inflation. So you could explain that away. And I mean, we know from the basic fact that you cannot, to this day, reconstruct the potential of the inflaton just from cosmological data. That should give you suspicion as to why this
So just a small comment, is that if you measure a spectral index of 0.5, it's true it wouldn't falsify inflation, but it would make a lot of people uncomfortable.
And in fact, we couldn't live in this universe in a spectral index of 0.5.
Well, let's say over a small unit. Okay, the converse argument is that it's reassuring that the predictions, that the observations so far agree with the simplest expectations of inflation.
But it could, okay.
So I don't disagree with your point.
Yeah. Right. But, I mean, in a certain sense, you know, getting a scalar invariant spectrum is almost, you would expect that from just having some sort of time translation invariance, you know, and in the initial state. I mean, whenever you have a time like Killing vector, it's very difficult to not get.
Actually, one more point is that the only way that I can think of to falsify inflation, although I don't have a proof yet, but
I'm not saying there's no ways, but there are. Yes.
One way that I think is true is if you were to measure a slightly blue spectrum of gravity waves, and I think that's where you're headed, right?
You should distinguish between falsifying inflation and falsifying slow roll single field inflation exactly. Because essentially four.
I believe it's a result that you cannot. I think it's very difficult, no matter how you try to look up your inflation, to get a blue tilt or gravity.
What I said is almost.
But slow roll single field inflation, there's three parameters and there's four observables. The blue tilt and the amplitude for the tensor and scalar model.
And are they independent of each other?
Well, because there's three parameters and four observables, there's one relationship amongst them, which is that's not sure that that's falsifying that whole class, which is the most abundantly used class of models. And since we're harassing you, I have to object to the Trans-Mikan story, because the way you phrased it, it would apply equally well every time someone turned a magnetic field on. Because the issue of states coming in, you know, so if I have lambda levels, they go up to the Planck scale in principle, and then as I turn a field off, the spacing levels goes to zero, so they all come in from infinity. There's lots of
this. But you assume that there's some, you know, UV completion to your, you know, electrodynamics theory that.
Finesse scientists just don't care.
Right.
At some level, the thing is that the would always, it's just the fact that you have states coming in from infinity, that happens a lot of time in their problems, and it never causes you any trouble, because part of the whole package of effective field theories in the time-dependent context is maybe of intensity, which is guaranteed to be true for this, because the scales that you're dealing with energies are slow compared to the Planck scale. And there's no evidence at all that Mullins is any different from that.
And I actually agree with that. That's why, I mean, I just said naively some people think that's how I tried to preface it. I mean, I agree with that statement. I personally don't think there's a transpacking problem, but some people do. And it's not a settled issue. Right? I mean, there are people that would disagree with it, and much more clever than you have arguments.
We have to have them be black or something. Sorry, can I?
Sure.
So the statement about the blue spectrum of the gravity wave, is that the same? It's also applied to DPI inflation as well?
I don't have a proof, and I'm not giving the seminar, but the short answer is I think so, because they're not violating. To get a blue gravity wave spectrum, you have to violate the non-energy condition.
In inflation? Or in general?
In the way that inflation generates perturbation. Okay. But I think your point is that you get a blue spectrum, but maybe not.
You get different tilts for the scalar. So to jump to the conclusion, you get a different tilt for the scalar versus the tensor mode. One is red, one is blue. So to outline the rest of the talk, which is going to focus on this NBD mechanism, I'm going to just give a brief overview of an old idea, actually, that's just been recycled in this work, of how quasi-static initial states can solve the horizon problem, not the flatness problem, just the horizon problem. And in particular, how strings at the Hagenborn temperature could also provide the finer structure on top of the observed cosmic microwave background to predict a scalar invariant spectrum. After which I'll discuss open issues of this mechanism, of which there are a few. And I'd like to, if time permits anyway, I mean, I'm already halfway through my talk, I'd actually like to throw that onto the floor for discussion. But at the very least, and the perspective I'm taking in this talk is let's assume that this model is true, or let's assume that some point in the future someone comes up with something that does better than this, all we really need is the background to do certain things. And in that case, I would like to show you that you could go away and calculate a lot of potentially physically interesting and measurable quantities. So all of the usual things that you want to measure, inflation, such as the tilt and the running of the spectral index, the tilt and the running of the tensor mode index, whether these perturbations are adiabatic Gaussian and how they get squeezed. So I think that's a fairly comprehensive list. There may be more. And at least those are all that we've checked so far. And finally, I'd like to compare and contrast with inflation and show that one could actually discriminate between these two mechanisms quite straightforward. So, these are two space-time diagrams representing two different universes. Okay, the first one starts out in a quasi-static phase, and so what is a quasi-static phase? It's a phase that's almost static. It's almost like Minkowski space. And what happens there is H goes to zero, so H inverse becomes divergent. And if you assume that it ends smoothly, okay, all that's happening in that universe is that the universe is somehow static, okay, and then it just starts expanding. Getting that, however, is non-trivial, but that's this old idea of loitering, which was invented in Toronto, CETA, in the mid-80s, as a way of explaining the horizon problem. So what happens there is that modes during the quasi-static phase are static. The universe isn't doing anything, so they're not evolving. But once the quasi-static phase ends, there's a dramatic reduction in the Hubble radius, and it starts to then expand linearly, or we assume that it expands linearly, which any sensible matter content will do. If you get any sort of power law with n power less than 1, you get a linear Hubble factor. Subsequent to that phase, modes will have exited the horizon during the transition out of this quasi-static phase, only to re-enter later. So that's not going to be the full story, because the full story is you also want to make sure this loitering happens long enough such that all the modes ended up in causal contact. So that's there's two things that go into there. Inflation is not so complicated, and is in fact a lot more simple. So you get the same thing, modes exit during inflation, rather, and then enter later in the usual way. The Hubble factor, the Hubble radius is a constant during inflation, then it starts, after reheating, it starts expanding linearly, and then initially modes get forced out of the horizon, only to enter later. So both of these mechanisms can solve the horizon problem. Inflation also solves the flatness problem. This doesn't. So in a certain sense, you know, if you look at these two, if you look at these diagrams, you just sort of want to make the observation that exploiting quasi-static initial state is somehow the inverse.
Isn't it possible that I can get any kind of tilt even in a quasi-static case? Because
it depends on your physics,
very much on the slopes. If I make the slope something like this, then I
can. I don't think you can conclude that just from this diagram. You can't. Watch, I'll show you. But you can't just conclude you get a certain tilt just from the slope of this graph.
No, I can change the slope from. I mean, not slope, I mean, I can change the, you know, if we made this way like this way, no? If I change it like this way in a very weird way, then can I kind of change it? Because it depends very much how you're.
I mean, this is time, you can't make it inflect. You know? But the answer is no. You can't tell just from the shape of the curve. So, now, okay, I'm going to begin in a universe where you have this initial quasi-static phase. So in particular, at around the string scale, at around the Hagedorn temperature, Taitlin and Balfe showed that you can, in fact, have a quasi-static initial state to begin with. But this is not a fixed point for the equation. It's not a stable fixed point in the equations of motion. That period is going to end, and you're going to end up with an expanding number of dimensions. Okay. Ideally, that would be 3. So one of the assumptions that I'm going to make is that you have a situation where you start out with your usual 10-dimensional compactification. Now it's on a torus, but now you've got 6 dimensions sort of tucked away. And three dimensions are loitering at a scale that's much, much larger than the string scale. And the reason we need that, I'll make clear fairly shortly, but that is the initial state that you would like. It can be done if all dimensions, if there's no hierarchy between the dimensions, if they're all sort of, at, if all 10 dimensions are isotropically just sort of loitering around the string scale, that's been shown by Tatum and Bapa. But here we're asking for something slightly different. But nevertheless.
So the dynamic you describe is all string.
Well, the dilaton gets frozen towards the end of the Hagedorn phase. And I'm really mostly only interested in the physics at the end of the Hagedorn phase. So, yes, it's done in the string frame, but it's actually done in the Einstein frame. But insofar as you're saying that the dynamics in the dilaton are not relevant because it gets frozen, then you don't have anything to worry about. But of course, I'm going to get to this. There is something going on with the dilaton that you have to pay attention to that might mess things up. But if we just begin with the metric for a perturbed space-time in a certain gauge, it's a longitudinal gauge, it's a perturbed Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time, you have one scalar metric fluctuation degree of freedom. That's phi. And in this space-time, we have the following 0-0 Einstein constraint equation, which relates that fluctuation to the fluctuations in the matter density. Okay. And the thing that we want to evaluate is this dimensionless.
But I want to make sure I understand the assumption. So you're going to neglect anisotropic stress.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely, that goes into it. Do you feel that's it tends to be done fairly blindly, but it may.
Okay, I don't know. Enough.
Okay, but yes, yeah,
there's a reason why you neglected your story. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about that right now. It needs to be thought about. Yes.
So, coming back to the issue of the dilaton. So the meta that produces UFRW universe is a string gas, right?
Well, at this point, it's fairly close to Minkowski, right? It's a quasi-static phase, and it's
but you have a gas of string, right? It just
close to
that. It's a string, as you know, it couples to a dilaton. So a string sources a dilaton.
Yeah. Yeah. So this has been worked out by Taylor and Bob in 1991. They studied the equation of motion they computed the low energy effective string theory coupled to a string gas where you evaluate its momentum relative to the one loop free energy, studied equations of motion. This is what they included.
Do you really have a gas of string or one very long closed string?
You have a gas of
string. Wait a minute, near Hagedorn temperature?
Yeah, I guess.
I don't understand why.
Where would all the other strings go? You're thinking of something else right now. I know what you're going to get at, but you're thinking of something else right now. Okay. Right? You just have a gas of strings. Let's start at zero temperature. Let's start at zero temperature and you have a gas string. You're saying if you increase the temperature, all of them will disappear into one long string?
I would expect that one long closed string will dominate.
Yeah, six long strings will be
dominant. Will dominate, yes, but there's still a gas string there.
Not thermodynamically, is much more probable that you would get one long closed string.
But why is this different? Why is that important? Because it's a single string.
That's what I mean. Because you need some kind of like interaction to happen,
All of the interactions are with the thermal depth, made up of the strings themselves. So usually you can take it to fairly good.
Just this question will be very relevant. If there is, say, for instance, one very long closed string.
It is a relevant question.
Then,
but not for the reason you're saying.
But why?
Because it's not as if the whole universe is just populated with one long string. You have a fluid string.
No, the universe is not popping. You are heating up the bag. Those strings essentially.
You see, okay. I don't even know if that's necessarily true that one long string tends to dominate over all of the others. If that were the case, then you would have to think about this. Yeah.
To
just a quick comment about what's on the transparency. Mm-hmm. Bottom right equation, what is in the expectation value and what is the subscript?
Over here, constant volume.
No, the right equation.
Here?
Yeah, what is it? Is that delta what?
No, that's R, the radius is equal to K inverse. This right. K, this, so this is saying you're computing, I'll explain this. So, okay, so the thing that you're interested in calculating is this dimensionless power spectrum, okay, which you know, can define as scaling as k to the n to k n to maybe a function of k if it runs minus 1, and n is the spectral index. So if you use this constraint equation in Fourier space, okay, this just pulled out a factor of k squared, you can convert this expression. Okay, where this is now some expectation value in inflation, you can take a quantum mechanical expectation value. Here we're going to take a thermal expectation value in the canonical ensemble. In this particular situation, you can re-express this power spectrum as the following quantity, where this now is the mass squared fluctuations of the mass squared, the variance of the mass fluctuations in a sphere or a box of size r equals k inverse. That's what this subscript is supposed to mean. And if you were in a canonical ensemble situation, or a microcanonical, you write down your partition function as following, and you compute expectation values in the obvious way, you find that the fluctuation of energy, this is just an identity, it essentially equals to the temperature squared times the specific heat at constant volume. So if we substitute this in here, thing that we need the thing that we end up with is that the power spectrum is now given by this quantity times k squared times temperature squared times the specific heat of a string gas. Now the specific heat, so in order for this to be scalar invariant, you immediately see, since we're computing this in a box of size r equals k inverse, what you're saying is that you want the specific heat to scale, not intensity. Now, that would be a very weird thing to ask of a typical thermodynamic system. Specific heat is an extensive quantity. You double the volume of the box, you double the specific heat. But as was calculated by these gentlemen in a series of papers between 1989 and 1992, if you consider an ensemble of strings close to the Hagedorn temperature, in this particular situation where you have three toroidal dimensions being large, much larger than six others that are much smaller, you can compute the specific heat to be this following quantity, where the assumption is that G string is much less than one. Now, throw that back into this equation, and you see you have, to first approximation, a scale invariant spectrum. K does not, there's no K dependence in this factor. There's an implicit K dependence in this factor because these temperatures have to be evaluated when the mode K, so this has to be a temperature at the time of the mode K exits the horizon. That is going to depend slightly on the wave number, but the zeroth order, it's scalar invariant. You find, in particular, you can re-express all of the quantities that appear in front of it, all the dimensional quantities, you can arrange them into this following combination where you express G in terms of L Planck and alpha prime in terms of L string. And you then find that in order to get the amplitude of those of the power spectrum correct, you make a postdiction that G string has to be 10 to the minus 3. So that's consistent, certainly consistent with our assumption that we are at weak coupling. But this postdiction is similar to what you do in inflation. When you're doing inflation, you do need to tune your model such that your amplitude of the amplitude of your power spectrum matches up with observations. So that's just the basic introduction to what Nyree, Brandenburg, and Botha did. Now I'd like to discuss some open issues that I personally have with this setup. I'm not saying that they're fatal, but there's nevertheless there's something to think about. Namely, we know very well that we can get a quasi-static phase if all of the dimensions are of the same order, if there wasn't a hierarchy between them. But could we get that if there was a hierarchy? So namely, is it possible to get a quadristatic phase for three toroidal dimensions to be much, much larger than six small ones? The answer is, I could think of a way of doing it, but it's very baroque, and I would not actually expect it to be operative in the early universe. So there's a whole host of issues there. The second issue is, where's the dilaton? Like I said, the dilaton is frozen in towards the end of the Hagedorn phase. You can see that at the level of background equations of motion. But in general, you'd expect there to be some fluctuations around its background value. And those might introduce entropy perturbations, because you have now two different things that can couple to your scalar metric fluctuation that you're measuring in the CMB. And they might, in addition, introduce order one effects to the spectrum that you're calculating. Another issue that I'm quite concerned about is, you know, calculational control with respect to string theory. Now, in this case, unlike, you know, as I was insisting on earlier, you do have a situation where you're at a very high temperature, you have, you know, sort of Planckian densities or string scale densities. Is it really fair to be using the low energy effective field theory as the background for this? The answer is probably not. Okay, but yes, I'm just going to leave that issue there. But that's a big issue to me. And another problem is, this says nothing about the flatness problem. So at the very least, okay, and from this point on in my talk, I would like you to take the perspective that I am going to show you how, if somebody were to come up with something like this, okay, how it could have some very, very nice observational consequences. Okay, so that's the perspective I'm going to take in the remainder of the talk. And I'm going to show you how you have quite a lot of calculational control over potentially interesting cosmologically observable consequences. So this is the work that I followed up with Robert Ali and Kummer with.
So,
if
you move a little bit down there, so that number, I think it sends you to how close you are to the Hagedorn transition. So what's the assumption in order to get 10 to the minus 3?
10 to the minus?
You have a denominator, 1 minus 2.
Right. No, that's.
So what is, I mean.
Yes. Another open issue is this background is just sort of not convincingly derived, but that number will change, and it'll generally get bigger, which is better, right? Because 10 to the minus 3 is kind of ruled out by WMAP.
I would say this should get smaller. It depends on how much I can trust your approximation that the specific heat has a singularity at the Hagedorn. Just a simple call of the round, you know. How close I have to be to use this formula?
I mean, in general, you have to assume you start at some temperature below the Hagedorn temperature, but close to it. Right.
I have a related question, maybe I'll ask, but the spectrum you wrote down was a scalar?
Yes.
So do you have the same combination that appears for the denser spectrum?
No.
Because that also gives you a constraint.
You mean the scalar to tensor ratio? Yes, that's another constraint that comes in.
Also something that you mentioned, and it's absolutely not obvious at all. So if your model, the map in your model that drives the cosmology is just a string, as I said, it couples to the dilaton. So it's not clear to me that when you put strings at a very high temperature,
right,
as you said, the dilaton is going to be frozen at some small.
Right.
I mean, this is something that you can, you know, that could be studied. This is just a dilaton equation.
Yeah, this has been studied by Tiffin and Botha. I can give you the reference.
Oh, I know that paper. Yeah. So you're saying in that paper they showed that the dilaton.
Okay. And this isn't my model.
The string goes to zero, you're saying.
Huh?
The string coupling goes to zero.
I don't know where it is. I just know that it's frozen in wherever it is. I mean, you assume that you're at weak coupling. Okay. I don't know exactly the numerical. I mean, that's going to depend on initial conditions. But
they have to assume certain equation of state, and I can't imagine why the dilaton equation.
No, I think it will be always what comes up is that you have runaway potential, yeah. so it is likely that if what he's saying is really true, then you know I can assume that there is a randomly here, but again, you have to worry because there are dualities. Presumably, that's for a certain type of string theory. Because you know, if I do as duals, then if a dilaton is a you know minus infinity, it immediately becomes a plus infinity. So there are all these issues, but presumably, you know, there is a particular string model, and maybe indeed, Pops and Satan did do this and found that.
Put it like this, okay, when I was asking this same question, you know, what about the dilaton, is it really fixed, I was pretty much shot down by the senior most person in this collaboration. So, I wish he was here to tell you, to answer your question.
No, it's important question, so don't take me that.
Yeah.
It's an interesting model, and I would like to see how, what does it, because there is much more to support. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
And what was his reason? Could you figure it out?
Why? Well, no, he said that him and Taylor showed it.
Okay.
You know? So, okay. So now I'm going to just literally take, okay, so insofar as this model has a weakness, namely that there are a lot of open issues with respect to the background and whether the approximations that go into it are consistent, it has a lot of strengths in that, namely, the calculational control you have over the problem, given that you're satisfied with my previous caveats, allows you to really milk out a lot of things from it. And the first thing I'd like to show you is the running of the spectral index, the tilt of the spectral index. Now, the thing to note is that the dimensionless power spectrum has to be evaluated at a specific time. Okay, and that time corresponds to when that particular mode k crosses the Hubble radius. Okay, so p of phi of k has to be evaluated at this time for k1 and for k2 at this particular time. So the thing to note, okay, so this is just maybe direct, if I may direct your eyes down here really quickly, if the transition was immediate. That's an unphysical limit, but let's just assume that you have that situation. Then you are guaranteed to get a flat spectrum. Because all modes exit the horizon at the same time, and in that case, this formula here, you see this factor up here, this implicit dependence is all at the same time, and there is no k dependence there whatsoever. So in the limit that things happen immediately, you have a flat spectrum. In the more realistic situation where the transition happens over some finite amount of time, you have modes entering and exiting the horizon at different times. Now, since temperature redshifts is the following, this is the statement of how energy redshifts, and during the transition, recalling that all you have is a static universe that
it's not the temperature of one particle.
No, it's just the temperature of the universe, right? Yeah, and if you have a universe that starts out static and it starts expanding, it's going to redshift as 1 over a. It's how energy redshifts.
I just want to recall, maybe I'm wrong here, but is this the same relationship holds if you have strings, the temperature is case like 1 over a? I'm not very sure.
I mean, the temperature here is now just the property of the thermal depth. Right?
It's the sum of mass of strings and not.
That's going to redshift. I mean.
So that's a very valid question.
So what else would it mean? If you can show me that it's anything other than 1 over a, I'd be very shocked.
The assumption here is that the entropy is proportional to temperature Q.
Right.
That's why temperature goes to 1 over a. And so the question would be what's the entropy of the spring that I don't want to give another temperature?
Okay. Okay, I see your point now.
So it's near.
Okay, I see your point. Okay, so this is an error. Okay, this is a mistake, and I'll admit to it. It doesn't matter. Okay, insofar as I just want to show you how this allows you to. It's going to scale as some power as 1 over a, right? Or maybe as some function of a, maybe 1 over a plus c,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It's going to do something. But at any rate, you know then how this scales as your a changes, right? And you know that, and you know, for a wide variety of these, I've actually played around with this, you get that this will be a monotonic decreasing function as k increases.
But that will affect your spectral tilt, actually.
No, if you have any positive power of 1 over a or 1 over, as long as it redshifts, that's the key thing. As long as it doesn't increase, then you're okay, right? So as long as that's true, right? Okay, I agree completely with the collective consensus in this room that yes, this is a mistake, and it has to be checked. But the key point is that temperature reduces somehow. It just doesn't increase. That would be a very weird situation. And in that case, you do expect a slight red tilt. And we can.
It's actually not obvious because you know you in order to stabilize the direction, you need to have strings wrapping compact direction.
But now they're gone, right? Now that you start expanding.
They are, you know, I'm just saying that if there is an expansion, so you actually put more energy into those strings. So it's you have to be very careful. You really have wrapped strings, and they're
disappearing. The idea is that they're going away, and that you don't have them anymore. That's what's responsible for the end diagonal.
You don't stabilize your extra dimension.
No, but they're already wound, and they're just going along for the ride. This is purely 4D.
So you assume that other directions are stabilized.
And they're gone. They're out of the picture.
But there are strings there.
The strings that are wrapping that are relevant to this are wrapping the more large macroscopic.
Was there and if they are, if everything is a temperature,
well,
what is
this
the
is
temperature? It's for their Planck scale, so they will be very excited. And my point is that the thermodynamics of those wrapped strings is very different than thermodynamics of point particles, and that's what the point was made. And
that's the workhorse of this result.
And particularly in those things, it's actually, I would expect that it is with positive A, just for strings that are wrapping directions. I don't know, it's the thing, as you said, it's the thing to check.
Does that have an effect with respect to the truth, actually?
It would make it blue if it's a positive. If your temperature increased with the radius, it would make it blue.
No.
But the point that I keep trying to say is that the strings that, once you have a radiation-dominated phase, right, that's what you mean by when the Hagedorn phase ends, right? It's radiation-dominated. Right? Whatever strings you have floating around, they're not wrapping around.
You're calculating the spectral tilt or spectrum, and when you have this quasi-static phase, you're still string-dominated phase. You're not calculating these things in a radiation phase.
Mm-hmm. But it's at a time in which they're going away, and that's what's responsible. And in particular, since you're interested in, I was going to think out loud that whether focusing on the longest wave perturbation might make a difference, but I don't think so. But no, I think, okay, so Alex, your point is that basically you might be worried about temperature as an increase as a function.
It's very well posed problem. You should be able to do it yourself. Ladies, sit down and look what the Hagedorn thermodynamics of change is, and then do as Clint was suggesting. Assume that it is a geodetic expansion and see what will come out. And just look at separate cases when you have winding modes and when you have a momentum mode, and they will behave different. And just it's something that you know hopefully.
Mm-hmm. I mean the idea is at the Hagedorn phase, those winding modes along the three compact non-compact dimensions that are large are starting to disappear, mm-hmm. Right? And then you end up eventually with just you know a gas of just momentum being wound strings. So
then the dominant contribution, as you said, when it will be redshift.
Okay, but I see your point, and I'll remember it.
Since there's been many questions, feel free to keep going. So.
No, I'm actually since I started at 10 past, I'm going to end fairly soon.
No, but you can't keep going until 5:30.
I don't like to do that.
You're getting it right later. So.
Yeah. No, it's okay. Well, I'm almost done because I anticipate a lot of questions and I didn't prepare that in slides because I just to me it's just good manners to only take approximately an hour. So, okay. So modulo Alex's worries, and they are valid, and they do need to be looked at. But assuming that these winding modes are starting to disappear at the end of the Hagedorn phase, and they're not really going to outnumber the winding modes, that the behavior of this function you'll generically expect a red tilt. But we can do more than that. We could actually explicitly calculate it now. Now, in a form that assumes nothing except someone coming along and giving me a background. Okay, so all of this, all of these equations here are just a topology. Okay, assuming that of course that the form for their dimensionless power spectrum is correct, but I write down the power dimensionless power spectrum now as the following quantity, where if I assume okay that you might have some running of your spectral index, you have to introduce a pivot length or a pivot scale, which will take to be the string scale at some point, in order to keep this thing dimensionless as n runs. So if you were to just compute what you mean by this, you end up with this. Okay, but this we also know from our previous transparencies. Okay, and if it's not going to be 1 over a, and if it's 1 over a plus c, I've checked the case 1 over a, you get 1 over a plus c, you get this. Okay, but just some factor out here. It's not going to be, so for those of you who might be suspicious of this factor, all I'm going to say is that it doesn't really matter for what I'm about to show, you just get something different here. Okay, the key point is you get this factor and this on this side, because I'm going to cast this in a form that's very suggestive. So we integrate this.
You have a d dot k will also change this second term of your.
No, that's just by, that follows from this definition. This side is just follows from this definition. Okay, it's an identity, right? And on this side, I'm plugging in what we had in the previous one. And I'm saying, whatever it is that you get here, bear that in mind, okay? Whatever it is that you get here won't affect the form of what I'm gonna do next, okay? Which is, I'm gonna integrate this equation, okay, in this following form.
Well, that's hard to believe, that if you change the form, p goes to 1 over 8 to the power c, or 8 to the power minus c, for arbitrary c, you are then going to get the same.
Well, I'll show you afterwards, okay? It doesn't matter. Look, this is the only part of this equation.
There's a factor somewhere c will be hiding somewhere, so that's what I'm wondering. Maybe, okay, we can check it out.
Yeah, it'll be here. I keep insisting. It will. And if you have a different power, you'll get something else here. But how would you expect something else? I mean, all I'm saying, the relevant thing is on this side of the equation. Okay? This just follows from this definition. This is where the physics is. You can object all you want to over here. I don't care. It's going to give me something else. Okay? But the key thing is, with that integrating factor, you can recast that expression.
Yeah, and then it will affect.
And then it affects this answer.
Yes.
Yes.
Then it will affect. Yes. The factor c will affect, and it will.
But don't get excited. I was just pointing out the form of this equation.
It will not change.
I was just pointing out the form of this equation. Okay, there's some interesting physics already here. Okay. Relax. And the interesting physics to note is that you can express the tilt now in terms of how long the transition took. Okay, so in the limit that transition was immediate, the limits of this integral are the same for all wavelengths. It's 0. N is equal to 1 exactly. So if you had some background now, and so this is, so okay, so instead of here, instead of this, okay, if temperature does scale at 1 over 8, you get this. If it scales to something else, you'll get something else here, but this is the only place it enters. Okay, this statement is still true. Background determines the tilt. I'm assuming nothing, well, now I have assumed that temperature goes as 1 over A. You guys didn't want me to get that past you. But the thing to note is that you have something here. Okay? And assuming now, this is the thing that I would like everybody in this room to just sort of go away with, is the fact that with this phenomenon, you can express the tilt in terms of a quantity that's essentially an integral over the time of the transition. So now I'm really going to be a cosmologist and just do order of magnitude estimates. If it's a tree-level stringy process.
So the point is that it's always red. Is that correct? Is that if I go away with.
If that function, t over 1 minus t over th,
yeah,
decreases as k increases. Right? And that will generally be true if t redshifts with the expansion of the universe. Right? So you'll get a red tilt if t redshifts with the universe. This is the state. So, taking into account all of these factors and realizing this is a very, very small number on a cosmological time scale, you can make a quick and dirty order of magnitude estimate of what this is going to be. And again, you find that it's proportional to this ratio. And so that's saying now that the spectral tilt, if this model is correct, will be seen in the cosmic microwave background. Okay? Time some number of order, I don't know. Okay, so that could change, and that's where the background is going to, so that number comes from the specifics of what enters here and what this integration is, but this dimensionful factor, or this dimensionless factor, is not going to go away. That's still going to be around.
Generically, you would expect flat spectrum.
Almost flat spectrum, yeah, if G-string is weak, yeah. And so in this case, in order to get the amplitude right, okay, so we've already pinned down G-string by having to get the amplitude right. It has to be 10 to the minus 3, right? Modulo all of the approximations that are
in that factor, see, will not change anyway. Sorry, factor.
Well, if this transition took a long time, right, all of these numbers are positive, and this factor is going to be decreasing, so this number gets bigger. So this is all positive numbers. The longer the time is, the larger the number becomes. So it's going to get big. So similarly, if we had an explicit expression for of this, it's just absolutely trivial. If we have an explicit functional expression in terms of the background, it's absolutely trivial to figure out what the learning is.
I want to understand, since you're going anyway. So you say that if the transition happens very slowly, then you can make it, then it's flat completely.
No, if it happens immediately, then it's flat.
And when it happens very, very slowly, then?
Then it's not flat, then it becomes redder and redder.
So it means that my street coupling will also be very small in that case, too, because it allows my Hagedorn phase to last long enough. So then I'm a little bit confused with my intuition.
Say that again?
So my point is, if you say that the transition happens very, very slowly, it means then my string coupling is also very, very small.
No?
Or am I? I would expect so, because it's...
Oh, sorry, you're right. Yeah, I think the question is on your previous transparency. Mm-hmm. When you wrote the range, the interaction rate, you put alpha prime there. It's better to put G string there.
That's true.
In fact, saying gamma is equal to 1 over square root of alpha prime.
That should also have a G string in front of it.
Well, I think it is just a
G-string. You just call it G string.
Mm-hmm. Rather than that. And so
that how does the, you'd have to get the right dimensions, right?
Well, you can, yeah, I mean, it doesn't, you're assuming that everything is Planck scale, okay, so one of the, but, you know, there is, again, it depends, so what sort of the process, so that's an interaction of, it's a, you know, string interaction process.
Mm-hmm.
I would put G-string squares there, just to be completely naive, as you say, because
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
and that would change your scaling.
Okay. Absolutely. Yes.
So in a way, you will get a
but it's, but the thing I wanted to point out here is that, look, spectral tilt equals quantities that are expressed in terms of fundamental string theory.
Well, this is, you know, isn't that the generic thing? I mean, I guess my question is, well, you keep saying that this is such a big deal, but is it really a big deal, or is that?
I think it is. I mean, it's a matter of opinion.
In any
cosmology,
in any inflationary scenario.
This is not inflationary.
Well, okay, fine, but if I were to do inflation, I would again have something similar. At minus one equals something that depends on the potential of the input. You are not saying drastically different.
Right, but, okay, fine. But you have a lot of room to maneuver when you're coming up with potentials in string theory for inflation, right?
And then also, here also I have enough to maneuver because I do not know string coupling.
Well, it has to be weak.
No, but
and it determines the amplitude of the fluctuation. So it's pinned by that equation.
You can see it's a right scaling, so you can see you have a square root of, so it looks like that it's, that it comes,
So then you're saying there'd be a G string that appears in the numerator, G string squared that appears in the numerator.
Yeah, in your case, it will appear in the denominator.
Yeah.
So it's one over G, and so you are sort of running into a contradiction that, on one hand, in order to satisfy the small amplitude of fluctuations, you need to put the G string.
If what you're saying is true, then yes. Then you know, if this becomes G string to the
inverse, yeah.
Then you're lost. Yeah, then this doesn't work. Then I'll start working on this right now.
In a way, it's good. Then you can rule it out.
Yeah. But at the level at which I've done this, okay, I've assumed a lot in going from here.
Okay, we don't. And this is the point, because you have not included the, you know, kind of like degrees of freedom of strings. If it appears that there is
actually a real point, because all I'm saying is the delta t is one of which is strings.
Correct.
That's exactly what you were saying. If there are weakly interacting strings, that you expect the transition to happen very slowly.
Yeah.
And that's indeed, I think that's the real dynamics of strings would tell that is happening. So indeed, it looks like you have one of these strings.
So
it is physically expected, right? So if you have weakly interacting strings and the transition occurs by string annihilation and
Okay, so
it's suppressed. It takes a very long time.
Yeah.
So and as you said, the longer you make it last, the further I will be from n equal one. Everything comes, you know, and the formulas just shout at us those conclusions.
Okay.
But in a way, it's also good because there's one model where you would expect the spectral two to be bigger than one.
It's a way of fooling
this particular model.
Which is good.
I'm going home, guys. I just wanted to impress it. Okay, so this, I don't even know if my collaborators agree with this. Okay,
this is just thermodynamics. I mean, there's nothing more.
You just like it because it's attacking me. That's why you like it.
Are you gonna say something about?
Yeah, I'm getting to next. So, I can find it. Okay. So this. This I'm just gonna have to throw up at you, since you asked Justin. But I'd like to comment on just a few things before we carry on. So, in particular, you also find that whatever it is that your tilt depends on, your running is going to depend on a similar number, same order of magnitude. If you ignore the dilaton, these fluctuations are adiabatic, because in essence, there's no chemical potential that you're worrying about at this point. These fluctuations are Gaussian, even though they're thermal, and that's just a consequence of the central limit theorem. And because of Hubble damping, that happens as these modes exit the horizon, they essentially become standing waves after some amount of time. And so you have the right features to explain the acoustic peaks that you observe later upon reentry. So that's quite important. And this, I just have to throw up and I'm almost done, is what you compute for the power spectrum for the tensor modes. And so this is a slightly involved calculation, but you're more or less doing nothing spectacular. You're just trying to evaluate this quantity, Tij I1 j squared, in your ensemble, and equating it to the Hij, where Hij is the perturbation in the metric. And you can go away and you find that essentially you get a different dependence on the temperature on top, which causes this slightly blue tilt. So that's a paper that's already out in a fairly qualitative form, and a much more detailed one coming out very soon. But that is quite remarkable that something could predict different tilts for scalar versus tensor spectra. The thing to worry about, though, is that the scalar to tensor ratio, R, is typically going to be fairly close to 1.
It's not that you get different tilt for scalar and tensor. That's not surprising. In inflation, you can get this.
Okay.
You can have a blue scalar spectrum and a red tensor spectrum.
Okay.
The thing that's remarkable is you can never get, at least I know of no way of getting a blue gravity wave spectrum in inflation. So your thing is.
Didn't the cyclic.
We get very blue, right? So you get very blue, but you cannot get. And inflation doesn't get blue, that's my point. And here you're getting close to scaling variance, but slightly blue.
Yeah.
So it's this.
Well, it depends on these numbers.
Again. Well, again, maybe the arguments that we had before, but at least if this is off correct, then I would say this is a signature to the model. Right?
Yeah, that's definitely the attitude.
Another thing I would check is there are also consistency relations, as Cliff was saying earlier, in single field models. They are broken, so they relate, for example, scalar tensor ratio to spectral index. they're broken, they don't fold in multi-field models, but there are inequalities in multi-field models.
I think it saturates always, that ratio is always less than 1.6 times some number. In a still wrong case, I think.
Yeah, but so in your case, you might violate these inequalities, and that's also just purely from ratio. So yeah, so scalar tensor ratio compared to scalar index, you might also, because you have different parameter dependencies.
But Justin, isn't it depend on, say for instance, it depends on the contraction phase. If you make the contraction phase sufficiently long enough, then you can get also, in your case, very sufficiently diluted.
No, it's in our case, it's very fluid, the gravity phase spectrum.
But here also, he gets a diluted experiment.
But it's very small, dude.
Very small?
Well, it's logarithmically dependent.
Logarithmic dependent on the wavelength.
Oh, I see.
So I'm just going to conclude now. So the thing for me, anyway, we definitely do need a more precise realization for the Barrett to proceed. Okay. In particular, if you can somehow avoid having to introduce wound strings to keep those three large dimensions still lighter. In fact, if you turn on the dilaton, you can do all sorts of fun things with it. I just picked that as an example because that's what the main authors of the paper believe. You do need a precise realization of the background, but what I've shown, okay, so the only thing I want to impress is that give a background that does something, give a process that ends this quasi-static phase. It may be, you know, G string over squared alpha prime, it may be something else. Given that information, okay, I, as a cosmologist, can turn the handle and then determine cosmological parameters in terms of whatever it is that's responsible for the physics towards the end of the Hagedorn phase. And in particular, I believe that this, you know, might just sort of serve as an example of something much more generic. This is something I'm working on with Anupam right now. Is that there are certain features about this model that one might actually be able to abstract something that's completely independent of a specific realization. So maybe what's this space for a paper to come out in the next month. The other thing is, and in particular, if Alex's comment is concerning my ignorance of G-string, it's easily falsifiable. In fact, we might have already done that today. So, but that's it. So anyway, so. Thanks.
Very nice. So, any more questions?
I want to get a good